Here are some American voices speaking about freedom of religion.
Well, currently there's a lot of tension in America over religion. It's similar to when the Irish came here and they had tension with the Protestants, and now it's the Muslims having tension with the Christians. But I think these things will be overcome over time.
It's important for people to be able to have religious freedom because everybody has a different higher being. And I know who I believe in, and I think everybody should be able to believe in who they want to believe in.
Free thinking is important to me, and that the ability to worship or think in the ways that are best suited for your life and experience are important to me. The U.S. believes that it is special in its religious freedoms. Whether it actually is exercising a tolerance of diverse religions is something that it continues to try to work on.
You know, people should just be free to just, you know, think, you know, believe what they want.
Because I'm against religion, so I want to be free. In fact, there's a, have you heard of the Freedom From Religion Foundation? Yeah, I'm kind of like with them.
I value religious freedom. As a Buddhist, I believe everyone has the right to believe whatever they want to believe without any kind of reaction from the community or the government.
I don't want people making me practice their particular religion, and I would rather just be able to investigate any religion I'm curious about or have no religion at all if I want.
I don't really pay much attention to it. I just think that you should be able to believe in whatever you believe in.
I think that basically most people in this country don't value religious freedom because they take it for granted. They don't come from countries like in Eastern Europe where you've been forbade to practice religion. So I think, looking at it from that perspective, I think it's hard for an American to appreciate religious freedom because we get it so easily.
I think it gives a person a chance to express himself in a free country.
And freedom of your thoughts in spiritual matters, as all other matters, is a foundation for kind of a democratic society. I have to think that there is still some uniqueness to the American experience that clearly, historically, has valued freedom.
Welcome to Religion and the Constitution. This is a series of conversations about the law and what freedom of religion actually means in the United States. My name is Jerry Dunkley. In this segment of our series on religious freedom under the First Amendment, we're going to continue the discussion of two laws passed in 1993 and 2000 that have had a significant impact on the free exercise of religion in the United States. The first is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, signed in 1993. The second is the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, passed in the year 2000. They are intertwined in some ways. We're going to talk about why the laws were passed and about their impact, which has been quite significant. Let me say at the outset that these laws and their application are controversial, and people of good faith disagree about various aspects of them. Our guest is attorney Roman Storzer. His firm is Storzer & Associates in Washington, D.C. He is a religious liberty lawyer and has argued a number of religious freedom cases over his career. One of his specialties is the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, one of the two laws we're examining in these podcasts. Welcome to the program, the podcast, I should say. Thank you.
Good morning, Jerry. It's a pleasure to be here.
You have represented a wide variety of religious groups over your career. Is that not correct? Give us some examples.
Well, we used to say we've represented organizations from the Anglicans to Zoroastrians. I began my practice working with the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty for several years, after which I started my own firm representing predominantly religious organizations in a variety of First Amendment matters, and also specializing in the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act.
I'm gathering legal opinions about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and why it was passed in the first place, and then we're going to slide into RLUIPA. How do you pronounce it, by the way?
I use the phrase RLUIPA.
Okay.
I know others say RLUIPA as well.
What is your view about the RFA in the first place? Why the RFRA, I should say. Why do you think it was passed in the first place?
Well, the Congress passed it in response to the Supreme Court's decision in Employment Division versus Smith, which took away a large amount of the freedom that's available under the First Amendment to protect religious exercise.
It was an unusual case, was it not? It was peyote, and that surprises a lot of people because peyote is generally considered an illegal substance.
Correct.
Maybe if you could run through it just a little bit, what happened in the Smith case?
Well, there was an issue with respect to the use of an illegal substance by an individual that did not have the right to do so under existing law, and the issue was whether the First Amendment protected an individual's right to engage in what some would call a neutral and generally applicable law, and there was a lot of controversy as to what the applicable standards are under the First Amendment's free exercise clause. The court resolved it in that case by saying that an individual doesn't have the right to be exempt from a neutral and generally applicable law, which some believe contradicted prior opinions and some believe was just an extension of an existing standard that where no other religious or no other constitutional freedoms were at stake or the right for religious organizations to assert claims of autonomy themselves.
Just to clarify from a layman's perspective, the Native American was using peyote in his religious practice. He was fired because he was using an illegal substance. He applied for unemployment benefits. The benefits were denied. And the Supreme Court said that denial of benefits was legitimate because anybody who used any illegal drug was subject to the same law. Is that a pretty fair summary?
I think that's a pretty good summary.
And the Congress and a lot of religious groups responded very strongly at the time. They thought this was an infringement of free exercise of religion. And we'll get into aspects of that as we go along. When the Religious Freedom Restoration Act a few years later was declared unconstitutional as applied to the states, in a case out of Texas in the late 1990s, the Congress responded with yet another law, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. Now, how would you describe what that act does, the second act?
Well, the second act was a much narrower enactment by Congress that only applied in two contexts. One, where land use is involved, and the other involved prisoners' rights. This, in my opinion, these two arenas are the context in which the greatest threats to religious freedom really do exist on a day-to-day basis. A colleague of mine used to say that unless you're in a plane or on a boat, any religious exercise involves land use. And that's why there are so many controversies these days involving the LUPA. In the second context, prisons, of course, every aspect of a prisoner's daily life is controlled by the state, and that gives rise to plenty of opportunities for conflict involving religious freedom.
Is it fair to say that RLUIPA has extended First Amendment free exercise clause freedoms beyond what the Constitution specifically says?
Well, that's an interesting question, and there are people that argue both sides of that debate. It is certainly the case that the ability of a church, a synagogue, a temple to engage in fundamental religious exercise, worship, religious education, and such is closer to the core of First Amendment freedoms that are protected by the Constitution than, let's say, an individual seeking an exemption from a neutral and generally applicable law prohibiting the use of illicit drugs. In many contexts, religious organizations were held to have rights under the First Amendment to be able to engage in land use for their religious purposes, even before RLUIPA was enacted. There is also the interesting question of what has been called hybrid rights, where freedom of religion interests combine with other constitutional rights, such as free speech, the freedom to raise your children, property rights, and so on. And the argument can certainly be made that these rights that are protected by RLUIPA cover what was protected before, and thus RLUIPA is more of a visual guide to help governments, religious organizations, and courts apply the protections of the First Amendment. Now, on the other hand, there are people that believe that zoning regulation is simply a neutral and generally applicable law, and it falls under the holding of Employment Division versus Smith, and a church should have no more right than a big box store or a gas station in terms of land use regulation. I tend to disagree with them. I think that most contexts of involving the application and imposition of land use regulation involves what the Supreme Court has called a system of individualized exemptions, which creates heightened scrutiny under the First Amendment. In other words, it's not subject to the Employment Division versus Smith standard, where you have discretionary decisions made by a local land use regulatory body.
I understand that there have been a lot of cases that have popped up since the passage of RLUIPA. That means that people like you stay pretty busy with these cases?
We keep busy. There are several cases that are going on at any given time, probably far fewer than cases involving other civil rights protections, such as the Fair Housing Act, Americans with Disabilities Act.
Now, I want to talk about the RLUIPA law in relation to what a compelling government interest for a local, state, or federal government to make a decision that goes against a religious institution or practice. I guess the law says there must be a, quote, compelling government interest. Give us some examples of what might be a legitimate compelling governmental interest.
Well, the concept of a compelling governmental interest is one that comes from court decisions and really talks about issues of public health and safety, cases involving threats to an individual or to the community in terms of, we have examples of fire code regulations, traffic safety regulations, those kinds of things. What is excluded from that definition are most of the issues involved in land use regulations, which deal with, while legitimate, not necessarily compelling interest, issues of aesthetics, issues of historic preservation, issues of traffic volume, that sort of thing, which local governments certainly have the right to engage in as a general matter, but are not really issues of protecting health and safety.
Give us an example of a specific case you've worked on where the zoning regulations said you may not extend a church or build a parking lot or a mosque or a temple or whatever the religious entity is, and you had to, with them, go to court to say, wait a minute, RLUIPA protects this activity.
Well, we recently concluded a case in the Northeast involving a religious school, an Orthodox Jewish religious educational institution that attempted to locate in a particular jurisdiction. That jurisdiction's laws prohibited the use, and after the school applied for a variance from those laws, it was denied. And, on the basis of general land use interests, that is what was argued by the jurisdiction, issues of community character, traffic, parking, that sort of thing. We challenged their decision and their laws and were ultimately successful in a federal court.
And in that case, so the school was able to overcome the local zoning regulations because of RLUIPA?
Yes. There was much testimony and opposition against the use. There were claims that The idea of students praying in the evenings would be detrimental to the local community, and so on. All those arguments were ultimately rejected by the court.
If a community wishes to prevent, for instance, a mosque from being built in its neighborhood, and that because people in the community are not comfortable with the Muslim religion, that would be a violation of RLUIPA. Is that fair to say?
If the reason that was used to prevent them from building is because people don't want Muslims in the area, then most certainly that would be a violation of RLUIPA.
We're talking with Roman Storzer, who's a religious liberty attorney in Washington, D.C., with Storzer and Associates. Roman, another lawyer, Carla Chafee of Robinson & Cole in Boston, told me that the enforcement hammer, the power behind RLUIPA, is that the plaintiff can collect their legal fees if they win. Do you agree with that as a reality, or are there other penalties in the law?
There are Congress made available all appropriate relief in enforcing the provisions of RLUIPA. That can include injunctive relief as well as compensatory damages. Attorney's fees are available as they are in most civil rights actions under various laws that are protected by federal that protect federal rights.
So you don't see the attorney fee issue as being a driver in these cases, or is it your view that others are more powerful?
I can't speak for the motivations of local jurisdictions that choose to settle cases or allow religious institutions to further their missions. But if that is a motivating factor, then it certainly has a great positive effect in allowing the exercise of fundamental First Amendment freedoms.
I want to interject. I want to turn to institutionalized persons in just a moment, but I want to interject a question here for you because of a case that was just filed out west. It has to do with the pipeline issues in various western states. A land use claim has been filed by one or a coalition of the tribes. I'm not sure of all of the details, claiming that the pipeline going through their sacred ground is in effect a taking of their property that's religious in nature. Have you heard about that case, and do you have any reaction to it at this point?
Is this a case involving the Dakota Access Pipeline?
Yes.
That case presents an interesting situation. One of the requirements under RLUIPA is that the property is property that the entity bringing suit has some sort of right to. I'm not sure what the specific facts are in that case, but that I could see that as being one of the major issues that comes up.
Let's turn to institutionalized persons. What has been the impact of the RLUIPA law on prisons, in your view?
I think that it has. It's been used. We have less experience in that context, but it certainly has been used to permit. Prisoners to engage in fundamentally important religious exercise, to be able to have kosher food, to be able to be involved in group religious worship, to have access to religious texts that are important to them, and this is another positive effect of the law.
One of the things about that particular issue, and we should point out, if I understand this correctly, institutionalized persons in reality mostly refer to prisoners, but could also refer to people who are in nursing homes or government mental institutions, that sort of thing. Is that correct?
I believe that that's accurate.
One of the issues here that comes to mind is if it is let's say a state prison, that means it's a government entity. And if the state has to then provide clergy for the prisoners within the jail, doesn't that indicate an excessive, quote, entanglement of religion with government? Or are there exceptions for things like chaplains?
Well, the chaplains have a long history of working with the government, not only in the context of prisons, but in the military and other governmental bodies. the challenges to such involvement are generally unsuccessful. Again, this is not something that creates a real threat to the Establishment Clause issues that some people raise with respect to chaplains.
Let's circle back to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act for just a moment, specifically the Supreme Court decision in the Hobby Lobby case. To remind listeners, this is the case where the Hobby Lobby stores, a for-profit family company with strong religious beliefs, sued the federal government because they didn't want to pay for health insurance required under the Affordable Care Act that included certain kinds of contraceptions. Hobby Lobby won that case in the Supreme Court in a 5-4 vote. What are your thoughts about that case in relation to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act?
Well, the interesting aspect to me in that case is that the court reaffirmed that when you're looking at a religious freedom claim, the important thing is to understand and accept what an individual's claim of sincere religious belief is. In other words, it's not for someone else to judge what a plaintiff or some other person's beliefs, ability to worship, etc., is. There are a lot of religious traditions, forms of religious exercise that make no sense to people that don't share that religious tradition. And it's not the government's business, no matter which branch of government, to make a determination as to whether those beliefs are right or wrong.
One of the aspects of this seems to be that the government was attempting to do a law of, quote, general applicability, as you were discussing a moment ago, and yet the court said the religious faith of Hobby Lobby owners overrode that of the insurance needs of the women involved. Does religion have a higher level of power in our constitutional system now?
Well, I think it's two separate questions. I think that religion always had significant importance when courts are dealing with claims of religious freedom. It is enshrined in the First Amendment. It is one of our first freedoms, and therefore it deserves to be treated as such. In terms of the law, whether or not it was neutral and generally applicable, and I think that there's some significant question there. That's what the federal laws, both RFRA and RLUIPA, prevent, that kind of analysis. In other words, people have the right to engage in religious exercise, to believe certain things, whether or not such belief conflicts with a law, whether it's neutral or not. In other words, one example would be a prohibition on the use of alcohol could be seen superficially as a neutral and generally applicable law, but for the adherents of the Roman Catholic tradition, that would constitute a great burden on their religious exercise if they could not engage in the sacramental use of wine.
That's an interesting example. I guess one of the questions that I have as an observer who is not a lawyer is that does RLUIPA and the Religious Freedom Restoration Act open a can of worms that in effect gives a huge variety of possible faiths, everything from Satanism to atheism? You know, if I'm an atheist, I would say I don't want an employee who is religious in any way in my particular firm, or I don't want to support any kind of insurance that would cover them for X, that sort of thing. Do you think it's a clarification of rights religiously, or is it a potential can of worms that can get us into eventually a very broad question of issues?
Well, I think that the threat is much less significant than some make it out to be. There are two main limitations on these types of claims. The first is the issue of sincerity. In other words, while courts cannot judge whether religious beliefs are right or wrong, they can inquire into whether the claimant actually has those beliefs. In other words, if you have a prisoner that says it's my religious belief to have filet mignon on Saturday nights, Of course, would rightly judge as to whether that is a sincere claim of religious exercise. The other is the limitation on religious exercise that implicates what we were talking about before, a compelling governmental interest. If there is a substantially important reason to limit religious exercise, the government still has the right to do so, and the courts can enforce that portion of the law. If an action harms someone else, if it creates a threat to public safety, then it can be limited under these laws.
Let me ask you one more question, and speaking of cans of worms, this may be opening one of those. When the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was declared unconstitutional at the state level in a case out of Texas, and it still applies to the federal level like the Obamacare question, but does not apply to the states, many of the states began to pass their own Religious Freedom Restoration Acts. What is your sense of those laws, and are they going to survive constitutional muster at the federal level eventually?
I believe they will. They create, in the states that have enacted them, another level of protections for religious freedom that are not limited to what RLUIPA protects, which is land use and institutions. They apply to, generally speaking, to any form of governmental regulation. The formulations are a little bit different from state to state, but they were enacted in an interest to protect the religious freedoms of the citizens of their own states after RFRA was declared unconstitutional.
The American Civil Liberties Union responded nationally to some of these questions a while back in an article that was in the Washington Post. They said, yes, religious freedom needs protection, but religious liberty doesn't mean the right to discriminate or impose one's views on others. The RFRA wasn't meant to force employees to pay a price for their employer's faith or to allow businesses to refuse to serve gay or transgender people. That, in effect, that the laws can permit discrimination. Do you read them that way, or do you have a differing view?
Absolutely not. And it's unfortunate that the debate has been recharacterized in this fashion. The ability of states to enact these religious freedom protections has been used by far most often by those that are marginalized by society, people that are members of non-traditional religious faiths that are generally subject to the whims of the majority. Whether it's Native Americans or ultra-Orthodox Jews or Muslims, those are the rights that need protecting. It's unfortunate that in this one small arena, the baby has been thrown out with the bathwater, so to speak.
Attorney Roman Storzer of Storzer & Associates in Washington, D.C., sir, thank you very much for talking with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jerry.
Religion and the Constitution is meant to offer a brief history of freedom of religion in the United States. It's intended to help you interpret what freedom of religion means in everyday life. These conversations with the legal experts and the narration will not answer every question about what the courts have said about religious freedom. They do attempt to give you a basic understanding of the law. Nothing here should be taken as legal advice. If you have a problem concerning religious freedom, you should contact qualified legal assistance. Thanks to Josh LaBella for helping with the research and street interviews. And thanks to Tedra Schneider for creating the theme music. And thank you for listening. I'm Jerry Dunkley.